Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon, Tennis World. This is Bruce Lipka coming to you on Thursday, the 21st of February, the year 2013. All tennis players, all tennis coaches, students of the game, hopefully you're with us today because we are going to have a fantastic show here on the UR Tennis Network. Our guest today is Brian Shelton. Not only is Brian one of my favorite people on the planet, one of the best tennis coaches on the planet, no finer human being anywhere. He is a wealth of knowledge that will give us some information today as we discuss various topics in our sport that I think can help everybody take their games to a higher level. Our call-in number today, 714-583-6853. If you've got a question you want to email it in, you can email it to thebrucelipkashow@gmail.com. We've already got a couple of emails that came in off the Facebook post that Brian was going to be our guest today. So we are going to have a great time today on the show. Hopefully you'll stay with us. We're going to go to a commercial real quick. We'll be right back. This is the Bruce Lipka Show on the UR Tennis Network.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Folks, welcome back to our show today. Today, our guest is Brian Shelton. Brian, are you with us there on the line?
I'm here, Bruce.
Thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule as you rebuild the Florida program there into a national powerhouse and spend a little bit of time with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Hey, our pleasure. You know, Brian, I could list all your accomplishments, but that would take the whole hour of the show. So I just want to make sure everyone understands, you know, we don't get many guys who have done what you've done. I mean, you've won singles and doubles titles on the ATP Tour, All-American in college, NCAA championship coach. I mean, you must have an awful great passion for tennis. Where did it begin? Where was your introduction to tennis?
Well, you know, my parents, you know, I give them all the credit in the world. You know, they allowed me an opportunity when I was 8 or 9 years old to start with a little junior development clinic in Huntsville, Alabama, and that's where I was born and grew up. And so I was first introduced to the sport at 8 or 9, but I really fell in love with it probably a little bit later when a guy named Bill Tim moved to Huntsville, Alabama and bought the Huntsville Athletic Club and took over there. And he changed my whole world because at that point I was playing every sport that I could. And then when he came in town, I put every egg into one basket and decided that tennis was my thing, and I became passionate about it, and decided that I was going to pursue it for the rest of my life.
Now, what is it that went on? What's the experience you have? I mean, is it one experience, or was it a series of experiences, or was it an attitude, or what was it about what Bill Tim was doing that got you hooked?
Well, you know, it was his approach. I mean, it wasn't kind of one of these things that you just did on the side. It was all-encompassing, you know, from the physical parts that you have to put in to develop your strokes and become a player and become a better athlete, to all of the mental things that went along with it, as well as, you know, the emotional and psychological things that you deal with. And he was just, he is someone who's just an amazing teacher. I think he's the greatest teacher of all time. He understands the game inside and out, but he also understands people and the psychology behind the athlete. And so all of that, you know, put together was something that I hadn't heard or experienced in any of the other sports that I was participating in, didn't hear it much even at the school. And so it was really like just an education that, you know, you can't put a price tag on it. You know, the lessons that were learned through the things that we did on the court, through all the things that we did off the court. I mean, we spent as much time off the court going through video and what he used to call skull sessions to really understand the insides and outs of how to perform at a high level. And performing at a high level is not just about the tennis part. That was certainly something that we focused in on, but it really applies to anything you want to go after in life.
Well, I find it really interesting that, you know, we're roughly the same age, which we're not going to tell anybody, but, you know, we grew up playing tennis, and I grew up in South Florida playing tennis, you know, not that progressive of a place at the time, but you certainly grew up in the deep South, and I think I have a statistic, I'm not sure if it's right, you'll correct me, but I think you were the first African-American player to win a title in North America since Arthur Ashe on the Pro Tour. Newport, is that right?
That's right, Newport, the Hall of Fame championships up there in 1991.
Is that an accurate statement that I just made?
It is an accurate statement.
Okay, so be that as it may, I think that tells us that there were not a lot of African Americans playing tennis when we were kids. Now, playing in the Deep South where you were, and, you know, the country, it's still, you know, the 70s, you know, do you ever run into any uncomfortable situations where there was discrimination or any experiences along these lines?
Absolutely, Bruce. You know, I started playing tennis, I think it was 1972 or 73 is when I first started playing, and obviously things were changing in the South, but still had a long way to go. And so, yeah, we experienced some things. My mom is the one who really was the one in our family that kind of gave me the opportunity to play tennis. My dad wasn't a huge fan of me or of them really spending a lot of money and energy with sports. We have four kids. My dad was an Army guy, not a lot of money. And, you know, tennis, as you know, is an expensive sport. But my mom would take me to tournaments, and she'd find ways to save a little bit of money here, not pay a bill there, so that I could have the opportunity to go out and play and develop. And when we would go to tournaments, especially the first couple of years, if I won the tournament, a lot of times I wasn't invited back the next year once they realized that I was an African-American kid. And so that happened at a couple of different places around the South, and, you know, certainly not able to go into certain country clubs because of some of the barriers that were there in the South. And it's something that I always felt, but at the same time, my mom was very proud, and she didn't back down to anyone, and so she didn't shy away from the sport for me. I certainly didn't shy away from it, and there were a lot of good friendships that were made throughout the South, places where I received housing, so it wasn't that all doors were closed to me. There were plenty of doors that were open to me, and we always had a mindset that we'll focus in on the positive and not worry about the negatives. And, you know, so I gained a lot of things from going through that, you know, and I think those are things that helped me throughout my career of just understanding that, hey, if you want to get somewhere, it's not always going to be easy. It's not always going to be just wide open. You're gonna have to work to get through that door. And but if you can bust that door down, you know, there's plenty of opportunity on the other side. And so it's kind of a matter of just pushing and pushing and pushing and staying persistent. And, you know, I got that message from my parents at home. I also got that message from my coach, Bill Tim. And so it was a consistent message, and so I just continued to persevere.
Well, we're going to come back to the it's not always easy statement, because I love that. But before, you know, one statement and one question, one statement that, knowing Coach Tim as well as I know him, I'm sure nothing could have made him happier than having you being his student and you shattering, you know, perceptions and opinions and attitudes in the South. So I'm sure that that was thrilling. But the second part, the adversity that you faced, was it a fuel? Was it something that you just chose to try to ignore? Or did you not ignore it and use it to help motivate you? Or it was just a non-entity?
You know, I think it was a little bit more of a motivator. You know, I think that as I look back at my childhood and then early, you know, teenage years and then young adulthood, I think that things like that always seem to trigger a motivational impulse inside me to say, hey, someone's saying you can't do something. Someone's trying to tell you you're not good enough, you know, and you know, for me, I kind of use that as fuel to say I got to work harder. You know, I got to work longer. I got to work smarter to try
right.
to get there. And so it was definitely a motivator. Definitely didn't back down to it. I saw other examples, maybe not always in tennis, but actually in tennis. I mean, Arthur Ashe was a great example, you know, of somebody who certainly persevered and had great success. And he's a guy that really transcended tennis with the things that he accomplished in the world and creating more opportunities for people like me. So you saw people like that and Martin Luther King and others that sacrificed everything in order for others to have the freedom and have the opportunities. So I saw those things. My parents certainly put articles in front of me all the time of great African-American men who were doing great things and who had overcome the odds. And so there was always that thought that, hey, these guys have done it. Why can't I?
Well, along those lines, you know, playing for Coach Tim as a kid and
yeah.
developing your game in a certain way, you know, I remember, you know, we recently had a get-together, and one of the pieces of one of the pieces of paraphernalia, for lack of a better word, was a paper with the rankings on them from the Southern section, you know, probably in the 16s or so. I think you and Kenny Thorne probably in your second year 16s ranked, I don't remember, maybe around 12, 15 in the section, something like that.
Correct.
And, you know, you had an 18s ranking that you weren't in the 18s yet. But, you know, going through the juniors, it seemed like you had a good junior career, but it seemed like it culminated with a tremendous finish at Kalamazoo your last year in the juniors.
Well, it was something that we had targeted. You know, we were kind of working on a lot of different facets of my game through those years. And as you know, Bruce, when you're trying to play an all-court game, it just takes time. It takes time and a lot of repetition, and you're trying to form the right habits. And so, you know, when you're trying to do more out on the court, it's going to just take a little bit longer. And we kind of recognized that. I took a growth spurt kind of late as well, and you know, I felt like a little baby giraffe at times, you know, trying to serve and volley and do some things and stumbling along because I hadn't gotten my full coordination. And so I think Kalamazoo was kind of a culmination of a lot of hard work that we put in together, and it was pretty neat. I always felt like it was fun to chase those guys at the top, you know, and I felt
right.
like my whole junior career and my college career and even my professional career, I've always been out there to chase those guys at the top, and that's been something that's been fun to go after and to set goals and to go out there and try to achieve those goals. And one of our goals was to win Kalamazoo my senior year of high school, and fell a little bit short, ended up losing the semifinals to Aaron Crickstein, but, you know, to be in that position was certainly a huge confidence boost for me.
Well, then, you know, then it's college time, and off you go to Georgia Tech.
Right.
To play with your, you know, one of your better friends and doubles partner from the juniors, Kenny Thorne, and you guys showed up at Tech. And, you know, up until that point in time, I don't know how much success that Tech had had in tennis. What made you go there?
Well, originally I was supposed to go to school out in San Antonio, Texas. Believe it or not, I was supposed to go to a small school out there named Trinity. And Bob McKinley was the coach at the time, and I went out there on a recruiting visit, fell in love with the place, and just thought he was going to be a great coach for me, someone that could help me continue to develop. Well, he ended up leaving a few months after I had committed, and so I kind of, they weren't sure what they were going to do with the program, and I kind of decided I was going to look around a little bit more, and Gary Grohlman, who was at Georgia Tech, contacted myself and Kenny Thorne. He brought us in for a visit, and felt like he really sold us on the development piece. And obviously Georgia Tech's a great school. I was more math and science inclined, and so it was really a good fit for me academically, but from the tennis standpoint, I felt like it was going to be a great fit for someone who understood my game and could help me develop and continue to grow and get better. So that's what brought me to Georgia Tech. Obviously, you know, I continued to work with Bill Tim throughout those years. When I was even in college, I would make trips to Nashville every chance I could get to work with him, as he was still what I considered my coach and mentor.
Well, I'm still going to call you a pioneer because it was still, you know, in 1984, I think we played, when I was at Tennessee Chattanooga, we played Georgia Tech, and they were still so bad at that point in time that, you know, whoever was stuck on the court last finishing his singles match had to buy the first round that night. So that wasn't a very strong program, but, you know, so there you were, a pioneer, you know, really going somewhere with huge aspirations, you know, of being a professional to a program that didn't exist. So, you know, I think that bravery, to me, is what encapsulates your whole personality, which is why one of the reasons I think you've never shied away from things and have done some extraordinary things in your coaching career, which we'll get to. But talk a little about more the development of an all-court game. Define what you mean by an all-court game. What is it you were trying to do that you think a lot of those around you were not trying to do?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly when you talk about all-court, you're thinking about being able to be proficient from all areas of the court, you know, whether you're behind the baseline, inside the baseline, or at the net. And to be able to have the tools necessary to be able to play different styles. And for me in particular, I was more of a serve and volley player. And so I wanted to come forward at my first and best opportunity. And for me, it was following up my serve. And so I really wanted to develop different combinations with my serve of how I could come forward and apply pressure right away. I also wanted to be solid from the baseline, where I could play defense if I was on defense and try to get back to neutral in the point. But certainly my goal was to get on offense and get inside the baseline and then to work forward to the net. Sometimes in tennis, the second serve of your opponent is your best opportunity. And so I really worked hard on being able to attack the second serve and apply pressure and get forward on it. So I was consistently working to get forward in the court, which is certainly absent in a lot of today's game. But in order to get proficient up there, you've obviously got to spend time up there, and you've got to get past a lot of times and start to understand the patterns and how those things work, so that you can develop your anticipating skills and also understand where to position yourself on the court. And there's little nuances that probably aren't taught as much today as they were back when we were coming up, Bruce, that really teach you and things that you can think about so that you are in a good position to make the plays at the net. And obviously, you know, for today's player who's primarily playing behind the baseline, sometimes 6 or 8 feet behind the baseline, the only time they get to the net is to shake hands. So it was quite different when I was playing as far as what I wanted to do out on the court, and also the way that I teach now is trying to get back to being able to play in all areas of the court and understand what the right shot is from each position in the court.
Do you have a response for people who say that you can't go to the net anymore, it won't work?
Well, you know, it's just ludicrous, you know, and I hear it all the time. I hear announcers on TV talk about it. I hear coaches talk about it. I hear players talk about it. And, you know, it's one of those things that there aren't a whole lot of great examples out there of guys that are coming forward and having success or girls that are coming forward and having success. And because of that, we've got a gap. We've got a gap from the teaching standpoint of coaches who aren't really working with players. I mean, when we started playing under Coach Tim, he would start us every session at the net, and then we'd work our way back to the baseline. And it's the same way that I teach my kids how to play the game, is that I start them from the front of the court and then work back to the baseline. And today, very little time is spent in front of the service line. And so because of that, the kids aren't getting the repetition and aren't learning how to play in the front of the court, and they really don't know what to look for, and so they're trying to cover a whole court instead of being able to only cover, you know, maybe a third of the court or half of the court, which is much easier to do. So it's a process, Bruce, as you know, learning how to play an all-court game. And learning the patterns and learning how to anticipate. But once you understand it, once you really understand it, then you're ahead of the game. And I think in order to have ultimate success, you've got to be ahead of the game. You've got to know what's coming before it comes. Because today the ball is coming pretty fast, and the serves are bigger in general than they used to be. And so it's really important to be able to pick up on the cues and understand how to position yourself and what to look for from your opponent and how to anticipate. I think the great players, the Federers, the Nadals, the Djokovic, they understand the patterns of play. They understand what's coming before it comes, and they put themselves in a position to have success. And they also understand what shots they should be hitting that are going to give them what they want next. And I think that that's tennis at the highest level.
That's chess instead of checkers.
Absolutely.
One of my pet peeves that I'm going to share now with our entire listening audience, all four guys out there who might be listening today, is the way people warm up. You brought it up a little bit, and I want you to tell a little bit more about how you guys do it, but I don't like the phrase warm up to mean that I'm going to go have a practice session and I'm going to walk out on the court, and it's okay for me to lack intensity until I'm, quote, warm. In my mind, I'm going to do what I have to, so when I get the court, I got some sweat on the brow, I'm ready to go so that I'm forming the habits I need to form the minute I hit the court. My pet peeve is people standing on the service line and hitting ground strokes toward each other for many reasons. One, you get in the habit of letting balls bounce in the service box. Two, that's not a stroke that's applicable to anything ever done on a tennis court. So that's my own personal pet peeve. You know, is there anything out there that you really see that bugs you? And is that, you know, tell it, you say you start at the net and you work back. Talk a little about how you take your team. It's team practice. It's time to, quote, warm up. What do the first 10 minutes look like?
Well, I think we go through some things, like you said, before we ever hit a ball. You know, if our practice is at 2 o'clock, at 1:45, all the guys are out on the court, and they do a dynamic warm-up without the ball. So they go through a series of exercises to get a sweat going and to get loosened up and get stretched out. Once they're done with that, we have a little bit of a meeting with the entire team to kind of go over, this is what we're going to try to accomplish today. And so we work on, you know, a lot of times we'll start working on the volleys and transition and lob volleys and two-on-ones and different drills that will get us moving from the very first ball. And I agree with you. Probably my biggest pet peeve is players that let the ball bounce twice, you know, and it's a habit that most players have. Like you said, when they start to warm up, it's just lazy. So they end up wasting the first 15 or 20 minutes of the practice. And what I say is, if we've got 2 hours to practice, I want to get every single ounce out of those 2 hours. And so you do the dynamic warm-up so that once you start hitting the ball, you're ready to go 100%. And so I think that letting balls bounce twice just is one of the things I just absolutely despise. And I feel like hustle is one of the most important habits that any player can develop. And letting a ball bounce twice shows that you're not hustling. And so for me, that's something that was instilled in me at a young age by Bill Timm, is that, hey, one of the things we're going to do is we're going to hustle. And when we see balls bouncing twice and the intensity level low, we'll get the guys on the line. We'll do some running, you know, because one way or another, we're going to
move
out of the practice.
Yeah, that's my first pet peeve. My second pet peeve, which I see a lot from what I'll call is players in the developmental stage. And while I agree that, yes, Roger Federer can always get better and he's in the he can always develop better, I'm talking more about the junior players, the college players, the players who are working toward their potential. I watch them go out and practice. They go for an hour and a half practice, and, you know, 25 minutes of the practice is spent with maybe even more, two guys standing on the baseline, smashing balls down the middle of the court. Maybe then a guy moves to the net and volleys straight down the middle of the court while the guy smashes balls at him. It seems like a purposeless practice to me. What guys out there listening who've got juniors out there, what's one thing, or juniors listening, instead of them smashing balls down the middle of the court when they go out to practice, is there one thing or two things you would recommend to them that they might could add to their practice that might would make it more purposeful?
Well, Bruce, I think one of the most important tools that we can use when we practice are targets. I think that the ability to come to practice with a purpose is really important. And when you put targets down on the court, automatically there's a visual there that you're going for something, as opposed to just mindlessly hitting the ball. And I think too many athletes, you know, tennis players come out to the court and they shut the brain off, and physically they go through the exercises. And
right.
In order to really develop as a player, you got to put the thought with the action. And so I've had so many players through the years, Bruce, tell me initially, well, I don't do so well when I have to think about it. You know, I'm better if I just hit the ball. And, you know, I kind of laugh at that statement, because I always say that in order to be great, you got to be able to put the thought with the action. And the really great ones can do both. The ones that are just kind of mediocre are the ones that physically may be able to do some things, but mentally don't know how to process information, make good decisions, make adjustments on the court, make corrections, and go through some type of corrective methodology as they're playing so that they get better as the match progresses. Some of the things that, you know, you and I were taught at a young age, you know, a lot of players just were never taught those things. And so putting targets down on the court automatically gives you a purpose. Whether you're serving, understand that you're not just trying to make it in the box, but put specific targets down so that you're actually serving into a shaded area, you know, close to the line. And as you get more proficient, make that target smaller and smaller and smaller so that you start to tighten your focus. Same thing, even if you're doing cross courts, put a target down. Give yourself something to shoot for. Give yourself a number of balls that you're trying to make in a target area so you have a goal. So now you're working, and then find ways to compete with it. If you've got a team that you're working with and you're doing something as simple as cross courts, have a purpose. Maybe one guy's taking the ball on the rise while the other guy's hitting the ball heavy. Maybe one guy's working on a slice backhand while the other guy's working on short angles. But have a purpose with what you're doing so that you're developing the mental side of the game as well as the physical side.
I like it. Hope the folks out there are listening to that. You know, let's go to, so your playing career, 9 years, is winding down. You're
okay.
Thinking about, what do you want to do next? And was it always a coach? You wanted to be a coach? Was that always what was next for you, or was that an accident?
You know, I think that at the end of my professional career, I thought I was going to go into teaching. You know, I could see myself as a math teacher or something like that, and working with others and helping kids, I thought that was something that would be exciting for me to get into. But tennis was, you know, still my passion. And when I stopped competing in 1997, I got a call about 2 months later from Tom Gullickson, who was taking over player development for the USTA. And Tom asked me, he goes, would you be interested in coaching? And so it intrigued me, and, you know, obviously, you know, I didn't want to travel as much as I had traveled over the last 9 years, but, you know, tennis was still just, I mean, something that was, you know, a big part of who I am. And so I actually ended up getting hired by the USTA and worked in player development for almost 2 years. And then I kind of fell in love with coaching, just like I had fallen in love with playing, and realized that through coaching I could impact and affect more people than just myself. And so after a couple years with the USTA, I decided that I wanted to try something different. And then that's when I started working at Georgia Tech, as they hired me as the women's tennis coach there.
Well, we are going to take a real quick break.
Okay.
And jump to a commercial. When we come back, you're going to explain to everybody how the women's team at Georgia Tech, that probably never had much of a winning season, made the second round of the NCAAs in your first year out of nowhere, and then went on to win a national championship. So that's a story, folks, that you want to hear. This is Brian Shelton, our guest today on the Bruce Lipka Show. Our call-in number, 714-583-6853. Brian, stay with us. We're going to jump to a commercial. We'll be right back.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
All right, folks, welcome back to the show. Our guest today, head men's coach at the University of Florida, Brian Shelton. But, Brian, before Florida, there was the women's job at Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech comes to you, asks you to be their new head women's coach. School had virtually no history of success in the program. The day you got hired, you thought you could win a national championship there, or you even surprised yourself? What went down?
Well, you know, it was still very early in my coaching career. You know, like I said before, I had a couple of years' experience working with the USTA and working with some of the top-level juniors. And I wasn't really sure what to expect when I arrived back at Georgia Tech, which is my alma mater. And when I got there, all I could see in the first couple of months was errors. You know, I'd go to practice and all, you know, it was pretty tough, you know, because I'm used to, you know, just coming off the professional tour only a couple years earlier and then working with the very best juniors in the country. And then I go to Georgia Tech and I'm with the women's program, and I mean, they're missing balls all over the place, Bruce. And so for the first couple months I was thinking to myself, "Oh my gosh, what have I gotten myself into?" And after a while, I'd say 3 or 4 months into it, you stop recognizing that the level was just a lower level. You just kind of just realize that, hey, players are starting to improve. And that became really exciting. And as I saw the season, you know, progress, and I saw our players getting better and saw them doing things they'd never done before, I had the girls all serving and volleying on first and second serve and doubles, and they'd never done that. And they started taking pride in the process and kind of buying into the things that I was trying to teach. And all of a sudden, we got better through even that very first year. And by the time we made it to the NCAA championship, which was, you know, the first time that they'd gotten that far, you know, we were actually competitive with a lot of good teams. And we certainly weren't one of the best teams, but we were competitive, competitive enough to go out to UCLA and win our very first match in the NCAA championship, and then to lose to UCLA in the second round. That was pretty special. And at the end of that match against UCLA, I knew I was exactly where I was supposed to be.
Right. Was there a methodology that you had that was your own? I mean, you hadn't been anyone's assistant. You're coming in from, quote, the outside. Was it a combination of what you'd done as a player when you played at Tech? Was it an experience you had with your coach as a junior? Was it what you did on a pro tour? What did your practices look like, and what was your influence toward that direction?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, you gather information from all of your experiences, but certainly I'd say the biggest influence that I've ever had in tennis was with Bill Timm. And, you know, he's influenced my coaching through all these years. And if you've ever been around him and been with him, there's no way that you won't be impacted in a major way. And he's certainly someone who impacted my vision for the game and the things that I believe strongly in. Are there some differences? I'm sure there's a few. But overall, you know, what I wanted to do at Georgia Tech is to develop all-court players. I didn't care if they were men, women, boys, girls. It didn't matter to me, but I wanted to see these players develop fully. And so I didn't put barriers on them where I said, well, this is the only thing that you can do with your game. I said, we just got to spend the amount of time necessary in order for you to develop other areas of the court. And so those are some of the things we did. And we didn't worry so much about the wins and losses. I mean, we were competing hard, but our main goal was to make improvements in their game and to develop. And as the season went along, even in that first year, we could see that happening. And it just took a lot of repetition. We had to break some bad habits. We had to develop some new habits. And as you know, it just takes time. And so, but always a positive mentality, looking at the positives, having the players on the team talk positively about their own games and each other, and creating an environment and creating a culture there where hard work and working smart were just part of the culture there and just something that you did. And I think that in creating that over time, we were able to do that. And so that when the next freshman class came in, they just had to look at the other players that were already on the team, and they could just follow suit. And that's what you want in any program that you build, and that's what I'm trying to do here at the University of Florida. Bring in the right people initially, and then teach them. Teach them how to go about being a real professional, you know, and being totally committed. And so once you've got a team full of players that are like that, you can accomplish anything, Bruce, and have a lot of fun doing it. And so we want to create a fun atmosphere there. We want to create an atmosphere where we were teaching, not just going out there and rolling out the balls and just hitting the ball up the middle of the court, but always, you know, working on something with a purpose and having purposeful practices. And understanding that there are certain goals and certain objectives to every match that we played, being able to look at the video and look at and analyze the matches and spend time evaluating them. We had our players always keep a journal where they record their game plans and record the things that they were working on, put their goals down on paper. So we were creating a program. We weren't just go practice every day. We had a program in place there that we really stuck to, and we kind of were looking long term. It wasn't a 1-year project. It was something that we were committed to, and it was a long term approach. And I think when you have that type of approach, you make good decisions, decisions that are going to allow you to build a strong foundation and have something that when the weather gets tough and the winds blow and everything's going on crazy around you, that you're still standing firm. And so those are good, solid principles that you build the program on. And, you know, I developed a lot of that through Coach Timm.
Well, you know, to your credit, you know, you're making it sound easy, but I want to point a few things out. So you took over some girls who, whatever level they played at, you got them to eliminate some errors, maybe go to the net every now and again, and, you know, you're tied for fourth in the ACC, one of the best conferences in the country in women's tennis. Fantastic. Got up to fourth, stayed there. In 01, you're in fifth. In 02, you're in fifth. In 03, you're in fourth. In 04, you're in fourth. Just kind of hanging out the same area. Then all of a sudden, you win the ACC. You go 21-4. You make the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament. That is the first major jump. Now, of course, from making the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament, you do it again in 06. And then in 07, you're a national champion. Again, I'm not sure which jump is bigger, you know, from fourth to first in the ACC, or from second-round NCAA to Sweet 16, or Sweet 16 to being a national champion. Those are humongous jumps. I mean, how does that happen? What is it you were doing, not only to catch other people, but to surpass them while everyone's practicing? All the other teams are practicing. They've got returning players, new players coming in. What is it that you think you were doing that made your program run in a more efficient and more effective way than everybody else?
Well, I think we were going deeper, Bruce, you know, and I think that that was the biggest thing. I don't think that we had more talent than other teams. We still weren't getting the top 10 or top 20 kid in the country most years during that span, but we were getting the kid that was kind of obsessive about tennis. And really obsessive about just being successful in whatever they were doing. And so that certainly helped. We did a good job of bringing in kids, kind of the blue-collar kid that, like an Allison Silverio, a Christy Miller, a Kirsten Flower. I mean, some kids that, you know, actually some of those kids are from the Midwest, which was a great recruiting spot for us, because those are kids that weren't able to play tennis all year long. And so when they played, they absolutely loved it, because they didn't get the opportunity to do it as much as maybe kids in the South or in Florida. So I think that was part of it. But the other part is that we just had deeper, more meaningful practices. I think our players were, you know, Coach Tim used to always say the difference between a successful person and someone who's unsuccessful is that the successful person is willing to do the things the unsuccessful person is not willing to do. And so I call those things now separators. And I feel like there's certain separators that you can take hold of that will put you ahead of the competition. And so I try to always find those two, three, four, five things that I think will separate us from other programs around the country. And I think if we hone into those things, those are things that ultimately your players can take pride in, you know, such as serving and volleying on first and second serve. Well, Georgia Tech's doing that, and other programs aren't doing that. Why are they doing it? What's so special about them? It's a separator. Keeping a journal and keeping up daily in your journal and making sure you're making good notes and evaluating and sitting down in long sessions before matches and then sitting down in long session after matches, going through the video on a weekly basis, going through and doing those things, all these things are separators that not everybody else is doing. Sure, everybody's out there hitting the ball, okay? Mm-hmm. Everyone's putting in their 20 hours a week in college tennis, whether it's on the court with conditioning or weights and stuff like that. So you've got to find those other separators, things that other people aren't doing, and be willing to go a little bit deeper and a little bit more thorough with how you prepare every single day. And if you pay attention to the details and you focus in, you will eventually catch the competition. That's what I believe, and that's what I've kind of hung my hat on through my years as a player and also as a coach. And I've found that when you get get players that buy into that and are obsessive like I am about it, you're going to get better. You know, you're going to get better faster than the competition.
Well, I think it's an understatement when you said you weren't getting the better players at Georgia Tech. Recruiting a female athlete, student athlete, to go to school in downtown Atlanta at a science math-based university, I mean, that can't be easy anyway.
Pretty tough.
So you put, what's that?
Pretty tough.
I mean, the only tougher places I can think to recruit might be, I don't know, West Point, I don't know, something like that. I mean, this is not an easy place to recruit. So you're kind of getting girls you're getting. And there are some of your results, you know, I'm not a really a result-oriented person. I'm kind of a process-oriented person. However, the results say something. You know, it's an accumulation of an effort. And I don't work toward the results, but I look at some interesting results. One, you know, the interesting results that I've seen when I look at your history as a coach, of course, is a jump from Sweet 16 NCAA to a national champion. You know, I mean, someone has to learn how to win big matches. You know, to just jump from, you know, never having been there to doing it is incredibly impressive. To go in 2010 to finish seventh in the conference regular season and then be the tournament champions, that's remarkable. It says to me there was a thought process going on with your athletes when they competed that wasn't limiting. They didn't have limiting beliefs. They didn't see themselves as being stuck at a certain level, but they engaged in the possibilities, apparently. Did you address this mental stuff off of the court, on the court? Were you trying to build that, or is that just a happenstance of your process?
Well, Bruce, that's a great question, you know, and obviously you go a lot deeper than most people when you talk about the game of tennis, you know, and I think that is important. You know, I think it's one of the things that we really stressed with our tennis players, especially as we got close to tournament time. And, you know, I love our record in finals of championships. You know, we were perfect. You know, if we made it to the final, we won. We got to the national indoor title team championship match twice, and we won both times. We got to the ACC championship, I think, four or five times, and we won every time. We got to the NCAA championship final once, and we won. So we were absolutely perfect when it came to playing in those championships once we got to the final. So that's something that I took a lot of pride in, and I think it didn't just happen by chance. I think it's the way that we prepared for those matches. And when I say prepared for those matches, it's more than just the day before or the week before, but it's the years and the amount of time put into doing things the right way so that when we finally got in that position, we were able to, with our preparation, feel confident that we were going to go out there and play our very best tennis. And also I felt like we had enough tools at those times that we could make a game plan to go out there and play that was effective against the players that we were playing against. We certainly had an opportunity to see those players. Maybe we had played them earlier in the season. Maybe I had just watched them at that tournament, at that site. But being able to formulate a game plan and have tennis players that could go out and execute that game plan because they had enough tools to be able to do that. And I think that's one of the issues with player development today in our country is that the players are all developing with a hammer, and everybody is hammering the ball. And not many people have a screwdriver or have a wrench or have some other tools in their basket or toolbox that they can call on when they need them. And so if you need a different answer and you're coaching and you need someone to make an adjustment, but they don't have the tool set to be able to do that, that's very frustrating. And so by working on these different tools and being able to develop the slice and be able to take the slice to the highest level, which is to be able to float it, to be able to knife it, to be able to play it short, to be able to angle it, to be able to do a lot of different things with it, if you can do that, now you have a tool or multiple tools that you can use effectively when you play. And so my goal was that when we got to the championship time, that we would have enough tools to be able to be very competitive and have a good chance for success against any player that we encountered.
Well, you mentioned two things that I'm giggling over here. One is you talk about the tools, and my favorite presentation of all time was watching Coach Tim do a presentation at a convention where he had a piece of wood, and he had a hammer, a screwdriver, a nail, and a screw.
Okay.
And he put the screw on the piece of wood, and he said, "Can I get a volunteer up here who can put the nail in the put the screw in the wood?" So the guy said, "Yeah, volunteer to come up here." So Bill handed him a hammer.
Okay.
And he said, "Put it in." He says, "Well, that's not the right tool to put the screw in." He's like, "Oh, okay, go sit down." You know, and he got another volunteer to. He says, "Okay, the nail. Can someone put the nail in?" And everyone thought like, "Oh, I get to use the hammer now." So they came up there, and Bill handed them the screwdriver. And he said, go ahead, put the nail in the wood now. They said, well, it's the wrong tool. And the whole presentation was about if you don't give the juniors the tools, you know, if all they have is a hammer, then everything better be a nail. Because
that's
if
right.
it's not a nail, you're screwed.
That's right.
And, you know, and that's from the junior development point of view, I think that's a great point to make. And the responsibility, you know, for me falls with the coaches. But more importantly than that, from a developmental perspective, I feel as if the missing component amongst most of the professionals in our field, I can't speak globally, but I can speak what I see in the United States. And, you know, everyone has a different role they play, but I feel strongly that technique has to be driven by tactics. You've got to know there's a certain tactic you wish to employ. If you wish players to come forward in the court and move to the net, there are a certain series of shots that they need to have. If you want players to use the front of their opponent's court, there are certain shots they need to have. So if we teach the technique based on the tactics, it seems as if we might get somewhere. But when the tactics are at the mercy of the techniques that have been taught, I think you're in a sinking ship.
Well, that's an excellent point, Bruce. I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, that's where the frustration sets in for the tennis player, you know, when they know that what they're doing is not good enough. You know, there's
right.
always going to be someone that might hit the ball better than you, might hit the ball heavier than you, might hit the ball harder than you. But there's an answer out there. I mean, there's an answer with every single player on the planet. Some might argue that there's not a very good answer with Djokovic or Murray or someone like that. And, you know, but there are answers. And it's whether or not you have the tools to go along with the answers. And
well,
you're absolutely right. I think that's where the frustration sets in for so many players.
Well, we had, you know, Paul Anacone's coach was on the show, and I asked him that question that you just brought up. And he said that, you know, the job of the player in competition is you've got to get your opponent uncomfortable. You can't – all these guys ranked, you know, 10 through 150 who are going to play Andy Murray and Djokovic and Nadal and counterpunch them, they won't win.
Right.
They do that better than they do. So how do you make them uncomfortable? Well, you either bring them in and make them volley or you come in and make them pass. However, if one doesn't have that skill set, I mean – I look at a guy like John Isner, and of course, you're a wonderful guy, great player, and I only wonder what could have been had he learned an all-court game at a young age. How are you going to get the ball by this guy if he feels as comfortable at the net as he did at the baseline?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, to have that type of foresight at an early age, and you said, you know, you talked about the coaches and the coaching out there, and you know, it's a tragedy, really, in our country that we don't have enough coaches that are teaching players and looking ahead and understanding that there's always going to be someone that's going to hit the ball better. And to know that you've got to equip these young players with enough tools and an understanding of how to use those tools and when to use those tools and how they apply. I love talking about styles of play, you know, and looking at the different players out there and kind of understanding what their strengths are and where their weaknesses may be and how to get at those weaknesses and how to make that person feel uncomfortable on the court. Because like you said, I mean, you can make someone look foolish with one shot, a drop shot. You can make someone look silly. You can disrupt their rhythm. You can bring them to a place in the court that they don't visit very often.
Yes.
But how seldom does it happen when we watch tennis on TV, for that matter? And so, you know, it's been fun to see different players who do things well and who do go outside the box and use some of the plays that you and I have described today.
Sure. So 13 years go by at Tech, coaching the women, having fantastic success. During that period of time, were there any offers to move in a different direction?
Well, there were definitely, I've been, you know, talked to by the USTA at different times to come back and work in player development again. There's been a number of different colleges or universities that have approached me to come and take over the program, and I have interviewed at a couple different places prior to coming to, to Florida. But, you know, I really was on a mission there at Georgia Tech. I wanted to do something really special there, and I felt like we were able to do that. Certainly was a team approach, and I don't take all the credit for it. You know, I just kind of helped lead the charge, but I had a lot of good people that work with me, great assistants, great administrators, and I had some great tennis players that just wanted to be successful. And it really helped create this opportunity that I have now at the University of Florida.
So University of Florida came calling. You hadn't coached men before at the college level.
Right.
You know, they took, you know, perhaps a chance, one could say. What are you thinking walking in the door? What's the formula? Is it the Tech formula? Is it revised because you've been around a while, you know better now? What do the next few years look like at the University of Florida, which, for those listening don't know, is where I started my coaching career in 1988 as an assistant. And so, you know, I tried to lay the groundwork for you, Brian, years ago, but that's probably all gone by now. You might find an old picture of me with hair at some point. But what does this look like? What is this? What's the game plan now to bring a national championship to Florida?
Well, it's going to take a lot of work, Bruce. I mean, I think that we have as many resources as you could possibly have at a university here at the University of Florida. I mean, we have beautiful facilities. We have a huge staff. We have people that, you know, that are working seamlessly around the clock to give us everything that we need to be successful. The thing that we don't have yet is that culture, and that's one of the things that we first are attacking here, is to try to get the culture right. When I say the culture, it's more of a mindset, and it's a desire that goes far beyond your wants, but more speaks to your needs. You need to be successful. You need to work hard. You need to do things the right way. You really need to make strides in the right direction with everything that you do, both in the classroom and on the tennis court. And so we're trying to get that culture and get that started here. And we've made some steps in the right direction, but it's a long-term approach. And getting the players to understand that, hey, if you're here at the University of Florida, this is something special, okay? We only want people here that are all in. And when I say all in, that means physically, mentally, emotionally. When they're not thinking about it, when they're not on the tennis court, they're thinking about it. And
yep.
So we want kids that are obsessed with developing and getting better. That's the reputation that I was able to help build at Georgia Tech. That's the reputation that we want to build here. We want our brand to say, this is the place that you go if you want to develop and you want to take your game to the highest possible level. This is the place that you come if you want to be part of something special, if you want to win championships, if you want to do things that no one else has ever done here at the University of Florida and be a part of that. And so we're really working with our players to understand that. And the way that we do that is teaching them how to practice, teaching them how to train and how to do things in a professional way so that we build up this brand and build that reputation so that every great talent around the country wants to come to the University of Florida because this is the place where opportunities will match up with their dreams and their goals and the things that they want to accomplish in the game of tennis. So that's one of our first missions here. And like I said before, not going to happen because we want it. It's only going to happen because we work hard and we work smart.
Well, I have no talent. I'm a little old and broken down, but I do have 1 year of eligibility left, and if you'll have me, I'm there. I quit my job today. I'm fired up. I'm ready to go.
I think you have that obsessive gene that we're looking for, Bruce.
You think so? You know, a gene that works in some parts of my life but not in others. Well, Brian, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed speaking with you today and how much I love hearing about what you did, what you're going to do. I think that tennis and college tennis are fortunate. All the young folks out there who have a dream of getting an education, being a great player, reaching their potential as a human being, you know what? I'm coming to Gainesville if I'm them. So I think you got great things lying ahead of you down there.
Bruce, I appreciate it. I appreciate what you do. I appreciate your love for the game and how you use this radio show to kind of inspire others. You know, you certainly inspire me, and keep doing it, man. You're doing awesome.
Well, thank you so much, but like I say, I said this in the intro, you're one of my favorite people on the planet. It was an honor and a privilege to speak with you today, and I thank you for coming on. I'll let you run, get out on the court, get those guys going, Brian, and I look forward to the next time we speak.
Sounds good. Take care, Bruce.
You take care. Bye-bye. Well, folks, that's today's show. Thanks so much for joining us. Fantastic to have you spend time with us. To everybody out there who has a friend who might benefit from the show, they're all available. Going back to the beginning, you heard Brian talk about Bill Tim today. Well, if you go back to the first show we ever did, they're all podcasts on iTunes under the UR Tennis Network. Coach Tim did our first show ever. We've had some great guests, certainly Brian today, one of the highlights of our show, folks. Can't tell you that I'm more excited to see guys like him in our sport as a teacher, as a mentor, and as a coach of young people. Everyone tune in with us next week. We're going to have another great show. We've got a surprise guest. I don't want to give it away too soon, but we're going to have a great time. Everyone go out there and hit some balls and have a good week.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.